Good afternoon. Welcome, 2 minutes late, honouring my Cayman Islands roots, soon come, to this week's What Comes Next Live. My guest this week is John Alexander. John and I introduced, I think, through network connections, through a mutual friend, Alex Barker. She of pirate fame, and two-time guest on the podcast before. And John said, yeah, let's schedule this so that we can talk about my new book, which is called Citizens. And, I am fortunate enough to have a proof copy that I've been scanning through and making copious notes and ready to ask a few questions about. But I'm sure John will be doing lots of media rounds and far more important, conversations than this. In the coming months before he publishes, but he'll tell us all about that. But yeah, so I guess relatively conventionally, tell us a little bit about yourself and about what led to you writing this book, and then what are your core thoughts, and then we'll dig into it a bit.
Sounds good. So thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here. So I started my career working in the advertising industry, actually, and sort of stumbled into that world but very quickly started asking deeper and deeper questions about what the role of that work in the world really is. And ultimately came to a kind of question that began to obsess me, which was, what are we doing to ourselves, to our, what we believe is possible, to our relationships with each other, when we tell ourselves essentially that we're consumers something like 3,000 times a day? And I sort of went quite deep into that and went through quite a dark time, which we might want to talk about. I don't know where you want to go, Tom, so we'll have to see. But actually then I left the industry and I went to work for the National Trust for a bit, developed some different ideas and developed a new question, which is, what would it look like if we put the same creative energy that currently goes into selling people stuff as consumers into involving people in the world as citizens? Mm-hmm. And that's really where the kind of this set of ideas that has sort of developed into the book began. The underlying framework that I play with and that I introduce in the book, and really the reason for writing the book, was to offer a way of seeing the world and seeing the moment in time we're living in that I think we really need at the moment. I talk about a choice of this, of how we want to think of ourselves and each other in the world. I offer a set of three sort of possible stories. I talk about the subject story, in which the right thing to do is to keep your head down and do as you're told, on the basis that the God-given few who are in charge know best and will lead us to the best outcome for society. The consumer story, where the right thing to do is to look out for number one, get the best deal for yourself, on the basis that if we all do that, then individual self-interest will add up to the best outcome for society as a whole. Or the citizen story, and this is the one that I don't think we can see enough and is really the motivation for writing the book. And the citizen story is one that says all of us are smarter than any of us. So the right thing to do is to contribute our ideas, energy and resources to the great search for the best outcomes for society as a whole, as kind of participants in that work. So that's really the journey, the core set of ideas that I'm playing with and the offer I'm making, I think, with the book as a way of seeing the moment in time.
Yeah. So the three concepts or framings of our roles I'm going to slow down for a minute, of subject, consumer, and citizen. I think it's there's kind of a framing for me in looking at this, is that I'm a big believer in business as a force for good.
Cool.
I believe in purpose-led leadership, and I surround myself talking with business leaders, CEOs, business owners who actually manage to find that balance between running a business that serves the shareholders but also serves society, right? I keep hearing people go, oh, CEOs only care about money, right? That's true. They're just not the ones I talk to and not the ones I work with. So kind of, I was fascinated by the fact that in order to look at consumers and that idea of self-interest, that materialistic society that we've lived in, I guess, really since the Second World War, predominantly, last 70 years, and it's just been accelerating. What I was really interested in was the idea of the subject, and in two aspects. One is, goes back to the way leadership is still taught largely at MBA school, which is command and control, which is the omnipotent CEO has all the answers. But actually much, much deeper than that, it goes back to, the age of empire for Britain. I mean, it's a British audience broadly, but a global theme, but colonialism. And, I was on a podcast for a Cayman Islands community today, and we were talking about bravery. And I said, look, a lot of it just goes back to that. This, Cayman Islands are British territory. And it's just this idea that the mother country knows best. Mm. But why is that? And what sits for that? So it's just, I think, before we get into talking about the shift from consumer to citizens, maybe talk a little bit about that subject story and how, why that then makes the consumer story, why that then made the concept of the consumer story so attractive to all of us really at a point in time.
Yeah, I think that's a great question and a great sort of place to dig in, because it's so easy to think of and to respond to the ideas I'm working with by, which is a critique of consumerism and is a criticism of the consumer story, but I'm not doing a kind of black and white, like consumerism is evil and unalloyed evil and so on. And I think holding subject and consumer side by side helps to understand that. Basically, I mean, I think I go even deeper than you've just hinted at. As I was doing the research for the book, I started off, as you say, with this idea that the subject story, this idea of the God-given few who know best, the sort of the aristocracy in charge, as it had been the story of society at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th. And I sort of scratched the surface and was like, oh, this goes back to this is the sort of the age of discovery, back to the 1600s and the conquests and so on. And then I started scraping more. I was like, actually, this goes back a hell of a lot. I end up at King Sargon of Akkad in the third millennium BC and the first ever king. And it's really fascinating when you go there, because you go like that. He was as the first king, the first sort of known king, where writing systems had only just evolved and maybe evolved as a kind of dynamic of the subject story. But the bargain of that time was relatively clear. It was like a bargain of protection.
Mm-hmm.
A bargain of saying, like, in this time when the first walls are being created and people are sort of settling and starting to live, and disease is rife and raiders are coming from outside, the bargain of protection by a strong leader was incredibly kind of powerful and attractive. And I think there's quite an interesting analogy, quite direct analogy, with the times we're living in now.
Yeah.
But what you see in those dynamics is obviously also like deep oppression and a deep lack of agency in the role of the individual. So it's all sort of given to those who know best and in return for this protection. Mm-hmm. And so I think as we see that subject story collapse at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, and the Industrial Revolution, the rise of the middle class, the kind of the two world wars and people like being side by side in the trenches and not seeing their sort of fundamental like similarity. I think the consumer story emerged out of that and was a real sort of golden promise of freedom, of liberation, of like everyone can have the good things in life and we can actually fix the world fix the world by doing that. And so I think it's quite important to hold those two side by side to understand and be accepting of the attraction of the consumer story before maybe you get to its limitations.
Yeah, and absolutely. So it's exactly just, we need to know where we're coming from before we can work out where we're going to. And I think there's interesting a different way to approach that. And you talked about the word agency and we talk about self-interest. And so I got back as a, was born in Scotland, so I go back to a bloke called Adam Smith, who came up with the concept of economics in the 1700s. And we operate in a world of, well, relatively, in inverted commas, modern economics, which really goes back to 1970, when a guy called Milton Friedman stood up and said the sole purpose of the corporation is to enrich the shareholders.
The social responsibility of business is to maximize its profits, right?
Literally, the line I just gave you is what he said, and that's been the cornerstone of Reagan and Thatcher from 10 years later in 1980 ever onwards. So it's like the time has come for change. And your career, perhaps then, you know, whatever level you feel will help the podcast audience is, you know, you were in the career where you started out going, now I'm going to sell people a lot of shit, right? So yeah. a lot of stuff to ultimately maximize the shareholder returns for your clients. So what changed for you to go on your own, if you will, entrepreneurial journey? Because an entrepreneur, to me, will always say, will always give you almost exactly the same language. When asked why they started their own business organization and you're doing that, is the language is, I couldn't not do it. So yeah, I think that's a little bit about your background and story, and then what you've built, what you're building, and then let's get into the shift from consumer to citizen.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, I couldn't not do it, I think is bang on. It's, I mean, really, it came from staring at that question, what are we doing to ourselves when we tell ourselves we're consumers 3,000 odd times a day? Like, and I think in the age when Daniel Kahneman can win the Nobel Prize for economics by looking at unconscious processing and how our minds work, like, we just can't ignore the underlying impact of that sort of story surrounding us. And the more I looked at it, the more I was like, this is a fundamentally kind of individualizing story. It's an idea of ourselves that tells us that our agency is limited, implicitly tells us that our agency is limited to looking out for ourselves, and our power in the world, our power in response to these enormous challenges that we're now facing is limited to choosing between the products that we can buy. And that just fundamentally, like, the more I stared at it, the more I got to I spent quite a long time actually working on sort of selling greener stuff and that kind of thing and trying to sell better products and ethical consumerism and so on and so forth. But ultimately where I end up is that it's that aggregate impact. It's that underlying story which has got us to a place where now we face a climate emergency, and yet we're telling ourselves pretty much constantly that the most we can do is change our individual shopping choices.
Right.
We're facing a crisis of massive inequality, and yet we're in a story that still at some level says that the right thing to do is to sort of climb above the other and make sure that you're okay. And we're facing a crisis of loneliness at a time and stuck in a story that says that we're kind of atomized, independent, totally independent individuals rather. And I think that's what got me to a place where it's like, there has to be another aspect of it. I couldn't just stare at the negative. And then I started to sort of play with ideas and go, what's beyond this? And then started to see that there's so much beyond that. And when you start to look around the world and see the energy that people are putting into starting up completely different ways of campaigning, starting up completely different ways of running businesses, which involve people and give them agency in the world, starting running governments differently by inviting their ideas and energy. And I talk about Taiwan a lot in the book as a fascinating example. And then this language of the citizen and this idea of the fundamental kind of interconnectedness makes you go, there's something really possible here. And I had just the inkling of it to your question of, like, why did you start the New Citizenship Project, which is essentially a consultancy business that says our question really when we work with any given organization is, what would this organization look like if people were citizens, caring, creative, collaborative individuals who want to shape the world for the better, rather than consumers, sort of narrowly self-interested individuals who just want are out for themselves. And our work is sort of helping organisations go on journeys of kind of expansion and imagination that tap into people in whole different ways. Mm. And I think, so maybe you want to prod me in a different direction because I have a danger of rabbiting off.
I resemble that remark, even as a host. I do. There's a couple of directions I want to prod you in, but let's, as a really pivotal point, every word can have a different meaning to different people. I really like that you have a language, which I wrote down of, and I think it's something to do with the etymology of the Latin of it, of the word citizen, but it was like together people.
Yeah.
And as opposed to in the consumerist model, it's self-interest, it's selfish, it's, and then if you scale that to remember that every business is a legal person. So that it operates from self-interest. So the place I want to go, I'd like to go because you'll have different people interviewing in different ways. The place I'd like to go is how do we get your thinking beyond that? You've got some wonderful case studies in your book, right, including a couple of people I've been dying to get on for as guests and stuff. So, but how do we get beyond social enterprise into big corporations, right, and get them to start thinking in this way? But as a starting point, talk a bit about your meaning for the word citizen.
Yeah, so very briefly, I think one the distinction I draw in the book is the distinction between citizenship as practice and citizenship as status. And the idea of it's not about citizen, like what passport do you hold?
Right.
Those things can increasingly be bought, actually. And in a sense, that's the kind of consumerization of citizenship. It's actually about where's home for you? And that can be an organization or a geographic community or whatever. Where do you belong? Where do you contribute? Where's your agency? Back to that word again that you picked up on. And that's really the heart of the idea of citizenship that I talk about. And this brings us into the role of business. So as you said, like the corporation as an individual, currently businesses are consumers of society, and that Milton Friedman logic is an exact expression of that. They are that the right thing for them to do is to maximize their own self-interest. That's the sort of the frame that we're in. Mm-hmm. And yet then they think of people because, and the language in those organizations is all people are consumers. And when you start with that language, you're already on train tracks. I sometimes talk about language as being the sort of the scaffolding around which we build our institutions and ideas and, or even the train tracks that we're running on. And you can't break out of that. If you start by talking about consumers, the only idea you'll ever come up with is stuff people buy from you or transactions people make with you. Whereas if you start by thinking of people as citizens, and this I think goes to your question of how do you get the corporate, this is the only way that this is a way to outcompete. This is a way, it's only available, let's be clear, it's only available to organizations that have a sense of purpose, have a genuine sense of purpose, or up to something in there that goes beyond money. Mm-hmm. And that is because people will only participate in purpose. People won't participate in making you more money. People will participate in impact. And that's the distinction when you think of people as citizens is you start to ask, what is it people can do in the world? How can people help? Not just what can people buy? Mm-hmm. And that's how can people buy into this? How can people share their ideas and their energy and their vigor? Mm-hmm. And so the sort of thing I think I talk about organizations like BrewDog, which is a flawed organization, but very interesting one in terms of like the origins of crowd equity and open sourcing their recipes and all this sorts of stuff. But they've grown very fast as a business as a result. And I think the critical moment I think will come when we see the first really big organization realize that this is a way to first really big purpose-driven organization realize that this is the way that they can go forward, they can build themselves in the world.
I agree. I've been writing about this for quite a long time, and I put it into a simple model. You talked about the climate crisis, and in 1994, somebody came up with, I forget the name of the person, came up with the idea of the triple bottom line, which of course we now talk about a lot. But let's remember what the three elements of the triple bottom line are. To profit people and planet. And profit is first. So I just iterated it. I just nudged it forward. And I said the new triple bottom line is purpose, people and planet. But as somebody from a business background, it then has to make a profit.
Right? Yeah.
And then use the word, which is critical to me, because I call that the scale to impact model, because your drivers become purpose, which is, as I think we'd agree, is why do you exist apart from making money, right? It's not to make money. It's apart from making, aside from, what is your higher purpose? And it's not Mother Teresa, but what's the reason, right? So it's purpose, people and planet. And if you focus on those things, and keep an eye on on making profit and have that business discipline to it, you will scale your impact and you can do that. And so, there is, you know, there is some, we're preaching to I'm preaching to the converted here and as you. What's critical is that if you raise your driver to be your sense of purpose, you will attract people who believe in that. And one of the greatest challenges right now, and for the coming years that employers are realizing, is attracting, developing and retaining talent, people, humans. All right. And I think one thing I'd say from working, I work with a lot with senior business leaders around the world is, to be honest, a lot of the time they're not even aware that they are operating from a level of purpose. It's not an either or, and it's not a binary on off switch. I have a client that has a stated purpose of creating communities. That's their stated purpose. They actually do it. I don't think they really get how powerful that is in terms of attracting their clients, attracting their staff, and they have doubled in size in the last 10 years. They're going to double in size again and be one of the world's biggest at what they do. And they literally get involved with communities, community physical building, they're, you know, engineering design, right, is what they do. Right? And they do it all over the world. And that's what they do. And they have such a strong sense of values that sit under the purpose that it's in everything they do to the level where they don't really have to talk about it. Every single member of staff across the world gets it.
I mean, I do think this is true, but I think I am saying something different that goes beyond this in my.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
For me, purpose is actually having a sense of purpose is just the table money. It's like the entry stakes.
Yeah.
Like, it's the real stuff is this idea of becoming like inviting genuine participation.
Mm-hmm.
So Unilever is the sort of famous purposeful business and.
Sure.
They have never really invited participation. They've never really opened up and said and given people agency and invited the ideas and energy and resources of people. They've said we will be purposeful. And there's a sort of hero complex to that sort of behavior, in my view. There's a kind of you can have purpose and try and do it for people, or when it gets interesting is you have a sense of purpose that you try and fulfill in the world with people. One of the ways we sometimes talk about it in New Citizenship is what are you trying to do in the world that's so big that you actually can't do it without people? Because that's the right kind of question that gets you to a place where you're involving, not savioring. And I think too much of the sort of purpose-driven business world at the moment,
right
through, is still in that kind of hero complex in my mind.
Right. So so what you're saying is if I think of it as a level, I don't know a single business in the world that does what you're talking about wholly with their own people within the organization. All right. Yeah. And there are many that have the subject king using the language you used, metaphor for the CEO in the business. So yeah. It's, here's where I'm going. You all guys execute that.
Yeah.
Guys, men and women, you execute that. The businesses that are on the journey effectively are having citizenship as a practice within the org, what you're now talking about, which is getting me really thinking, is, and it will apply differently to different businesses, but the real brave level is we can't do that without you, meaning the people out with, to use a good Scottish term, out with the organization. That's at the moment, given so many companies have to get it right internally, and they might have tens of thousands of people around the world, that's just a fantastic anchor. What we want to do is so big we can't do it without you. Therefore, we need to be working together with you, the together people, the citizenship as a practice. Very, very cool.
Let's go on a flight of fancy. Like, let's take you over at the moment, right? So look at them. They're under massive shareholder pressure because they're, and there's been sort of really cynical stuff saying, well, what's the purpose of mayonnaise? You're talking nonsense. But mm-hmm. what if Unilever actually responded to that and said, no, we're going to up the stakes. We're not going to back away from purpose. We're going to lean in and we're going to open it up to people. What if they said, like, our purpose is actually to get to an age of genuinely sustainable consumption. Mm-hmm. And we want the ideas and energy and resources of everyone in the world to help us get there. Now, and just think, like, internally there's stuff. So, I mean, there's the famous case of Smol, you know, that the washing powder that actually was an idea that was had by a Unilever exec who couldn't get backing and so left and started outside. That's the opposite of what should happen. But then there's also, like, the whole population of the world is there as a resource for ideas. I mean, and yes, it's true that no businesses have yet really gone there. But, you know, a lot of them have gone there in different little ways. Like, if you look at, I mean, I mentioned BrewDog earlier, and they sort of, some of what they do, the crowd equity approach, where they sort of crowdfund when they're looking to start a new venture, which is really interesting. Like the Doghouse Hotel, they sort of found, so testing using platforms and technologies like that to test. There's a lovely business that was started by a friend of mine called Technology Will Save Us that actually crowdsources ideas for their products from their community. Like, these sorts of things are entirely possible, but they have to be framed in ways that make it joyful and meaningful to be participants in it. But if businesses can do that, those businesses will win in a big way because they'll be drawing on an exponentially greater resource base than their competitors.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, obviously Unilever is a classic story, and their previous CEO, who is now out of there, but he got forced out by the shareholders.
Right.
And I've spoken with the current CEO, who's a fellow Scot around my age, and he, if you cut him, he's basically like his predecessor. He gets the sense of purpose of Unilever. And yes, you're right. For those who aren't up to date with the story, there is some activist shareholders grinding away at them going, you're not getting returns this quarter. We want you to be more efficient, et cetera. And they're dying. They're cutting staff. But they could actually have leaned in more. Now, these are the really big stories, and we repeat these stories, and you mentioned Patagonia and their previous CEO as well, and things, and they're great stories, and everybody needs to hear them. I guess for me, I think what I'm really taking is this idea of that we got an idea that's so big and so important that we need people outside the company, and we need this I'm conscious of my language because I nearly said the other C word. We need the practice of citizenship, with everybody who wants to and can be and is involved with services we provide, products we produce and offer to the community. That's fascinating. And that can be in the myriad of tiny businesses that used to show up at the Meaning Conference in Brighton every year, right? Which are the ones who generally don't scale, right? And it can be in the mega companies like Unilever, but I'd love to think there can be a real sweet spot of well-established profitable companies in Germany. The basis of the German economy, for example, that are in the hundreds and few thousands, right? That still have they're not necessarily publicly listed and got that shareholder pressure, but they can have a different sense, like those 1,000-year-old Japanese companies that are out there.
So, I mean, imagine as well the cooperatives, and some of whom are very big. They don't have that, and they're not leaning into this. They're caught in the consumer story. If they could step into the citizen story, what could they do?
Yeah.
So many organizations that could really make a massive, massive leap with this sort of thinking, I believe.
So just to perhaps wrap it up, because we're keeping this relatively too short to roughly half an hour, remind us again, just that your language around that of the, you know, how purpose goes beyond and citizenship goes beyond the people in the business. And, you know, what you feel is available to businesses, corporations, if they make this brave choice.
And like as I said, the question I think people should be asking is, what is it we're trying to do in the world that's so big that we need people to help us do it? And I think the realization that I'm encouraging leaders to make is that there's a resource base out there. There's the most enormous untapped, creative, generative resource base out there. But if you see people as citizens, if you see people as the creative, collaborative, kind of motivated people that we are, then you can tap into that and you will latch onto something only if you're trying to do something worthwhile in the world, because they will sniff it out otherwise. But if you're trying to do something worthwhile in the world, there's a whole huge resource base out there that can let you do it in ways that you've never even dreamed of yet. If you have the confidence to facilitate and open up to them, not just try and do it for them.
Brilliant. What is it that we're trying to do in the world that is so big we need others to help us do it? Fantastic. I always love to give the guest the last word. You pretty much had it, but I'll stretch you. What else would you like to leave the audience with?
I guess my last thing would probably be that this is, I think what we're living in right now is a moment in time when all three of these stories are kind of in the mix. And I think it's a critical moment. We all have the agency to be part of deciding. We will, our actions, particularly the actions of the sort of people you're interacting with, Tom, will decide which story we step into.
Yeah.
If we just defend the consumer story and try and make it work a little bit better and incrementally and da da da, I think we're probably going to end up collapsing into the subject story, actually. But if we step into this, if we have the confidence, and it requires people to think of themselves differently as well. It requires a humility, but as a result, a kind of confidence. Then I think we can do something really special right now. And I think it's eminently possible. And if there were one other question I would encourage people to think about. So if the sort of organization question is what are we trying to do in the world that's so big? The personal question, I think, is what would you do in this time if you truly believed in yourself, but also in everyone around you? If you thought of them as being everyone around you as being creative and collaborative and caring, rather than starting by thinking of them as like, what are they in this for? What could you invite them to do, and what could you do yourself? Like, and I think that is the thought pattern we need to get into in this moment in time, because it's so easy to be cynical. And yet cynicism will be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Brilliant. Okay, and I'm just going to re-anchor the three words you repeated a lot. You must have been a copywriter in advertising as well. Caring, creative, and collaborative are three characteristics of citizens. So that's the world I'd like to live in. So it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for sharing. I know you're going to be really busy, and your publication date for your book, Citizens, J-O-N Alexander, is what, March 17th, I believe?
Correct.
So you'll be doing the rounds, I'm sure. And then when you've taken a breather from that, you'll be seeing which caring, creative, and collaborative citizens step forward to support you in bringing forward the thing you're trying to do that's so big that you need others to help you with it. Fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks,
absolute pleasure. Bye.